This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good evening, everybody. This is Vasma Farhad of the People Speak Radio Show. Here, when the people speak, we make a difference. Tonight's guest is return guest, author and filmmaker Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice in his other life, is a community minister, author, and award-winning filmmaker who lives and works with the Aboriginal people in Vancouver, Canada. For nearly two decades, he has led the campaign to expose and to bring to trial the churches and governments responsible for genocide and other crimes against humanity across North America. Kevin is also the co-founder of the International Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State, which has summoned Pope Joseph Ratzinger and others to appear before its opening session in September in London. Kevin is a consultant to many indigenous and human rights groups around the world and is a public lecturer on the topic. Hi, Kevin. How are you? It's a pleasure having you with us again.
Fine. Thanks for having me back.
I did not do the first interview with you, Kevin, so it is indeed an honor for me to speak with you. This is an incredibly stunning, profoundly disturbing story. Can you give us a brief history of what is being hidden from history and from the world?
Yeah, well, I would first like to suggest that listeners actually go to our website, which has all my research and evidence posted. This is the result of 20 years' work, really. It's at www.hiddennolonger.com. And on there is what was going to originally be my PhD thesis about 15 years ago, but it's all of the evidence, eyewitness testimonies, documentation showing that genocide in Canada and the United States was deliberately planned by both the church and state going back into the 1800s, that of the Indian boarding schools that were set up, half the children who went in never came back again because of a huge death rate that was deliberately created. A lot of these crimes are continuing today. We estimate that over 50,000 children died over a century in the Canadian Indian residential schools. We have documented over 25 mass graves across Western Canada where these children are buried. We've consistently tried to get attention brought to bear. The police refused to do anything about it. The government in Canada is presently trying to whitewash the whole thing with their own, what they call a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is really not allowing any of this evidence to come out. And so right now we are going to international courts, we're going to the media in Europe and around the world to try to get an international tribunal going that can put Canada and his churches on trial for a lot of these crimes. So that's really in a nutshell what I've been working on and how it's very much growing now into an international movement involving people who've survived these kinds of crimes at the hands of the church all over the world.
So this isn't just about Canada anymore, is it?
Not at all, really. In the United States, there were the same kinds of Indian boarding schools. The death rate was just as high. I've worked with survivors in America who've described to me exactly the same kinds of crimes of children being killed, sterilization programs where they were trying to wipe out whole areas so native people wouldn't breed anymore, medical experimentation, all the kinds of things that we documented in Hidden No Longer. That, on top of which, is not only the genocide against Native people, but part of the work we're doing now, I'm working with a couple of German lawyers who are attempting to sue the Pope, Joseph Ratzinger, for the fact that he, for years, has been covering up sexual assault against children within the Catholic Church and, in fact, actively protecting child rapists among the clergy in the Catholic Church. So, you know, this is about that as well. And, in fact, when we convene our tribunal in the fall in London, England, we hope to be establishing local forums all over the world where witnesses can come forward and describe how these crimes are still going on today.
How many of these residential schools were there in Canada?
Well, at the peak, there was you know, during the 1950s and 60s, there was over 130. These were mostly set up by the Catholic Church, although there were Protestant churches, you know, the United Church, where I used to be a minister of, and the Anglican or Church of England also ran schools. In the United States, there was a similar number, although the big difference there was that the churches didn't have the kind of power they had in Canada to pretty much stop the government from their attempts to close down or monitor what was going on in the schools. But there was this, like I say, the same kinds of, you know, on both sides of the border, the same kinds of crimes and tortures really going on every day in these schools.
All over. You have been pretty much persecuted by these very entities yourself, haven't you, Kevin?
Unfortunately, well, I guess you've got to expect it when you start naming the church and the state as actors in these crimes. But it's been on many levels. It wasn't just losing my job and livelihood after the church blacklisted me and threw me out, but losing my family, my employability. There's a continual attempt to to discredit and smear what I do, including, unfortunately, within the Native world. There's no kind of united opinion about this among Natives. There's some Natives who actually support the government and the churches and are pretty much like the top chiefs in Canada are pretty much paid to not look into this stuff. And you know, of course, in the white world, there's a lot of people refuse to even accept that a lot of this stuff went on. So it's a continual uphill battle. But the one good thing is that the fact that it's been out there for so long, people can't deny it anymore. As a matter of fact, in Canada, just 3 years ago, the Globe and Mail, which is the largest newspaper in the country, was forced to print on its front page stuff that I've been saying for over 10 years, and that is they finally acknowledged the enormous death rate in these schools. So, you know, when the main newspapers are saying half the children died in the schools, obviously they can't use the excuse anymore that it was just some random bad priests that were causing this. Obviously that's a result of collusion on many levels and in effect, a system at work to eradicate Native people and get them off their land.
May I ask you what this kind of information does to a person once you come to understand the totality of the truth that you're hearing?
Well, you know, that's a big one to deal with because it really shakes up everybody's world. And the usual reaction is when, I think psychologists call it cognitive dissonance, when you experience something which causes a lot of disorientation and causes you to question everything around you, the usual reaction is simply to pull back from it and not want to believe it and simply deny it. And that denial mechanism is a way we protect ourselves, and that's very much at work. But on the other hand, there are people who are able to look at this and say, well, this makes sense. And at that point, you're then forced to make some choices about, your allegiances, whether people keep going to these churches and giving them money. A lot of people who have written to me have said they're not doing that anymore. They don't want to support these churches once they've learned these facts. So I think, in fact, it's a real kind of a test of any person to see, well, how are they going to react to what's obviously true? And that's something that becomes easier when you realize that it isn't just a few people saying it anymore. There's a lot of evidence out there now to support this.
Well, as a minister, I can't even imagine the impact that it would have had on you. Here you've dedicated your life to faith and to based on principles, based on ethics and morals, and here you find this crushing, I can only call it insane behavior, coming right out of the church. How do you reconcile something like that with your faith?
Well, you know, even when I was in those churches, I didn't really kind of automatically equate my faith with the institution. I know that people can believe in the teachings of Jesus without going to church, without even being a Christian in many ways. But it did cause me to, I went through the same kind of denial and shock myself when I first began to hear stories. Like the very first Native home I went into, I heard these stories of children getting killed. And I tried to get the church on board and to try to look into this, but I was at the time pretty much threatened and said, they're just making all this stuff up, and if you keep listening to this, your job might be affected. I mean, that kind of stuff was said to me. But what I realized is that when it was clear that crimes had gone on, if I went along with that and looked the other way, I mean, that's under the law, being an accessory to a crime. And I realized that, you know, that's why these things could happen in the first place, because so many people were doing that, simply going along, you know. I think it was Martin Luther King who said that the problem in the world is not the minority of evil people, but the majority of people who know that evil's happening and just don't do anything about it. And I think that certainly was the case and still is with this.
Now, this is not just the church. I know that in some areas, the state has been named, the CIA has been named in some of these issues.
Well, the thing to understand is
And you know, I'll be quite honest with you, I don't even like that I just called it an issue, because this is not an issue. This is murder. This is genocide. This is heinous crimes against children, and I don't want to ever make it sound like it's just an issue, because this is not an ordinary issue.
Well, yeah, thanks for saying that. I mean, it's very true. It's really a matter of life and death, and you know, I often say to people, when white people deny this, I say, well, if it was your child and that your child went missing, along with many, many others, wouldn't you want them to be given a proper burial? Like, wouldn't you want the people who did it to be brought to justice? That's all we're saying, you know, to apply the same standard to Native people. And, you know, in terms of your question, the whole thing from the beginning was a joint operation between government and church. It wasn't just one or the other. The missionaries were often, like on the west coast of Canada here, the missionaries were often made judges by the colonial governments, by the British. So a missionary could go and set up their own courts, arrest any Indian who wasn't, you know, surrendering their land or bringing their kid into the residential school. That was pretty common. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police grabbed the children out of the villages. They hunted down children who ran away. You know, at every level, the government and the church was working together on this stuff. And when you mentioned the CIA, what we do know, and one of the things that we begin to document, is in the Indian hospitals, which were set up by the Crown of England and by the Catholic and Anglican churches, they were doing a lot of experimentation on children, sterilizations, things that appear to be related to mind control experiments that were funded by the CIA in the 1950s, especially the MKUltra experiments. They were using prisoners, military personnel, and also children out of orphanages and Indian boarding schools in these experiments. And it's one of the reasons the government sealed all the records to the Indian hospitals in 1999, so it's hard to look at this stuff now. But it's definitely showing that kind of involvement. And, you know, we know from the U.S. government's investigations in the 1970s, you know, the Church Commission looking into the CIA, we know that's when a lot of the information on these mind control experiments began coming out. So the Indians were just one group that were targeted in that. And, you know, it's one of the reasons that the government doesn't want to see a lot of this information coming out, because it shows a whole dark side of them that obviously, like the churches, they don't want exposed.
You know, it's almost unbelievable to think that this wasn't so far in the past. This wasn't like in the 1600s or 1300s. No. This was relatively recent.
The last residential school in Canada closed in 1996. A lot of them closed in the 1970s and 80s. And the effects continue. I mean, when you look at the people I work with, a lot of Native people on the streets of Vancouver, they didn't go through residential schools, but they have all the same symptoms because it was passed on in the family. And as long as the society doesn't look at the root cause, you can't really deal with those problems. So.
And this is not the first time that you've approached the International Criminal Court, is it, Kevin?
No, we held, the first time was in 1998, we held a tribunal in Vancouver. And we, a United Nations group came and heard 3 days of testimonies from people. There was an attempt to bring that to the United Nations, but it was shut down by interference by the Canadian government. You know, but we then after that tried a more grassroots approach. We had different Native groups and others around the world raising this in human rights councils all over the world. We finally got, you know, this action this year by some German lawyers to try to get the European Parliament to condemn Canada for its crimes in these schools, and that looks like it's coming about. So it's been a really long haul, but like I say, when the evidence is on your side, all you have to do is keep putting it out there, and eventually you'll hit pay dirt in some way, and that certainly happens, you know.
And the internet. Can you tell us about the International Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State? How that was founded, and what exactly do you hope that this group will do?
Well, again, it has its own website. It's itccs.org, and people can read a lot of the stuff on it. But what happened was last year there were groups in five different countries, consisting mostly of survivors of sexual abuse in Catholic churches, and that included Ireland, Australia, Canada, America, and England. And these groups came together and said, well, we need to put a lot of this evidence before the international community so that people can do more than just describe the crime. We've got to bring some kind of sanctions and legal action against the churches and government. And so this tribunal was set up right now to be an investigative body. It's convening in London, England in September. And we're also setting up local forums where people can bring forward evidence and videotape eyewitnesses and that. We eventually, out of that, want to produce a report and a documentary film that we can broadcast around the world and use that as a lever to get governments and courts to actually start bringing charges against, these bodies. So, we're really hopeful. There's a lot of grassroots interest. German television in Europe has been broadcasting our film Unrepentant, the documentary about the Canadian residential schools. It's been broadcasting that to over 10 million television viewers in Europe since August. So the fact that millions of people are now looking at this evidence, it's been a real help to that whole effort to set up the tribunal.
Do you hear from these people, Kevin?
Which people?
The viewers, people that are watching Unrepentant and...
Oh, all the time. I don't have time to answer all the emails and the requests for interviews and all that. It's... unfortunately, I don't have a staff around me, but which you need for something this big now. But it's causing an amazing response. Unfortunately, not within Canada as much. People here are much more reticent to look at, to even respond to the stuff.
Well, to be quite honest with you, coming from Michigan, we're close neighbors of Canada, and we often visit Canada. And I know the mentality of the Canadian people is that rather kind of a laid back, benign, not really instigating any major affronts or anything in the world arena. So that I think people are under the impression that they don't want. I can see why they don't want to shake the world view of Canadians. Do you find that to be something that that helps perpetuate this kind of mentality?
Definitely, yeah. Canadians don't want to lose or move from their comfort zone, which is they see themselves as, nice humanitarian people. That's often how the world sees them. But in order to do that, you've got to kind of close your eyes to a lot of what you already know and about yourself. And I actually find that less and less the case, especially among younger people. When I speak in colleges and that, I get a tremendous response, right, even in Canada. To this stuff. So I think, the important thing is to reach the young generation and show them more of the real history that happened.
Has the church reached out to you in any way?
Oh, just to try to sue me. there've been attempts at gag orders, lawsuits. What I often say to them is, well, bring it on, because I would love the chance to appear in court and start subpoenaing their documents and going over this stuff. But of course, then they don't want that. They don't want this on the public record. So it's more like trying to discredit me from the sidelines is pretty much being their response. But they have yet to acknowledge, any of this stuff. They've let the government pretty much take the fall. And, even the financial settlements is coming from taxpayers. It's not largely coming from church coffers at all.
There's this one, a lot of your film, Unrepentant, has to do with oral histories, where you're videotaping people talking and telling the story. which I think is really just, you know, unbelievable as deeply as it can touch a person. And one of the women on the film said that if they just admitted this, I could probably forgive them.
Mm.
That's huge. You know, how does, you know, I don't understand, especially in light of the fact that the Catholic Church has just, you know, admitted to all of these atrocities against young people in the church when it comes to pedophilia and the issues of pedophilia. Well, this is part of it. excuse me, weren't a lot of these assaults on these children not only just violent in nature, but also sexually violent in nature, that these children were being passed around among the government officials and clergy and for sexual gratification? Didn't they fall under that investigation of the pedophilia that went on in the condoned by the, well, maybe not condoned, but certainly not addressed by the Catholic Church? Didn't that come up somehow?
No, it didn't come up because, first of all, you talk about the rape of children, that was the common practice. It was standard procedure to do that to children in these schools. It was the norm. And it was so widespread and implicates so many people that right at the very beginning, the government and the churches in Canada, just like they did in Ireland, they indemnified themselves legally. They got together and they said, okay, we can't be held responsible for anything. We are going to sign off from any responsibility. In return, we'll give a bit of money to the survivors. So what the lawyers did is they got together and said, okay, you can talk about issues of sexual abuse, but you can't talk about children being killed. Those issues weren't allowed to be brought in Canadian courts. They still aren't. So in return for a bit of money and a so-called apology from the Canadian government, they're totally off the hook, the people who did these things. The churches are not held liable. And so it was a deal, an arrangement right from the very beginning that the perpetrators would make sure that they wouldn't be held accountable. To give an example of that, in the U.S., there was just a big settlement. There was a native law firm in Washington that just successfully sued the Jesuits for Indian boarding schools, a $168 million settlement. But as part of that, the Jesuits said that they did not consider themselves guilty of any crime, that in effect, in return for money, they're not admitting culpability in anything. So in effect, what they're saying is, no, you didn't prove we did anything wrong, but here's some money to you guys, and then you have to sign off from any further legal action against us. That's not taking responsibility. That's saying, basically, we don't think we did anything wrong. And that, yeah, to tell you the truth, that's the mentality among a lot of these people.
Right.
You know.
What if the parents, Kevin, what if the parents of these children, are any of them still, you know, alive?
Well, even the kids who are in there, the youngest ones, they're now in their 50s, 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of them have died. The parents who go through this went through a very bad time because they knew that they couldn't get, you know, they had to sign away. One of the documents I found right away, which I published up on that hiddennolonger.com website, is a document every Native parent had to sign where they'd go to jail. And it forced them to sign away the legal guardianship right to their own child, to the principal of the school, to the clergyman who ran the school. So that meant legally that you had no control over your own children anymore. And you know, what that did to any parent, it would just destroy them to know that you had no way of stopping that rape and torture happening every day and murder against your own child. So it destroyed the communities. I mean, it's why the Native communities are in such bad shape still, because it just pulled the heart out of the community when their children were all taken like that. And, you know, when that happens, to be frank, a culture doesn't really recover from that. It's how you effectively drive people off their land and destroy them as a culture, which of course was the purpose all along. So it's something that here and there you see with Native families, people are beginning to rebuild, but it's only when they have the right to and the chance to tell the whole story that they can begin to do that. And that's being prevented, you know, by the whole legal system, the government, and everybody.
You know, it's almost like the story of the Pied Piper. It's like you said, when the children were taken out of the villages died. Mm-hmm. People lost their spirit to live, lost everything, their identity, everything, as their children disappeared. It's a profound story, Kevin. Now this is something that's interesting, and I realize Pope Joseph Ratzinger has been summoned to appear before some of the opening sessions in London. But the reason I even ask about this is there was some talk about Nazis after the war being sent to Canada and experiments done at the hands of these Nazis?
Well, there's actually a lot written on Project Paperclip. You can find that on any Google search on the Internet. Project Paperclip was set up by the British and the Americans after World War II to smuggle out a lot of Nazi scientists. A lot of them were the rocket scientists that were used in the NASA program, like Werner mm-hmm. von Braun and those guys. You know, von Braun was an SS major who used yeah. slave labor from the local death camps in, you know, at Peenemünde there. And so ironically, he's going to work for the U.S. government, as did a lot of Nazis after the war. But part of that was some of the scientists they brought over had been working in the death camps of Europe in the early mind control experiments. And they went to work. There was one notorious case in a Canadian doctor, Ewan Cameron, was paid by the CIA to experiment on people, to wipe away their memories, to try to reconstruct personalities. A lot of that was given a kickstart by these SS doctors who were brought in after World War II. We have eyewitnesses who describe seeing doctors with SS tattoos on their arm working in Indian hospitals in Alberta, in British Columbia, in mostly Catholic schools and hospitals. Some of that's been written about, but of course it was heavily protected and covered up by the governments in Canada and the U.S., but you can begin to get a sense of that by looking at Project Paperclip and seeing, you know, the extent of how much that was happening after the war, although there were also recorded cases of it happening before the war. There was, in 1938, there was some boys in a Catholic school at Cooper Island in British Columbia who described German-speaking doctors experimenting on them. And we do know that the Prime Minister of Canada did have an agreement with Hitler's government in chemical warfare research in that during the 1930s. So, you know, it's the reality is that these genocidal practices went on both sides of the ocean. And Hitler often referred to, in Mein Kampf, he referred to, you know, he planned to do to the Jews of Europe what the Americans had done to their Indians. You know, so, I mean, the early sterilization programs and that, a lot of that he got from the eugenics movement in America. There's another good book written called War Against the Weak, America's Plan to Create a Master Race by Edwin Black. And he describes how a lot of the sterilization laws were first brought in America at the turn of the century to make infertile people, like the mentally retarded people. And those laws were aimed at natives as well, and eventually, you know, in Europe, in the death camp. So, I mean, these practices weren't confined to just any one nation. They were shared among a lot of the nations that did genocide, which were, you know, most of the major powers in the world.
Well, gee, I'm glad America is such a good influence on everybody. It is just amazing.
Yeah.
All right, the Pope. Have you heard anything from the Vatican on this?
We wrote to the Vatican 3 years ago asking them to identify the burial sites of the children who died in Catholic schools. We never heard anything back, although in October 2009, I conducted a memorial service and a symbolic exorcism outside the Vatican in Rome. And it was funny because the next morning...
I bet you that went over well.
Well, it was interesting because the media covered it. And the next morning, this tornado hits the center of Rome, which really impressed the Navy people over here to no end, let me tell you. But after that, we did get a phone call from a cardinal, fairly senior cardinal in Rome, who did say they would be willing to talk about that letter, although soon after that, these stories began to hit the press about Ratzinger's personal involvement in covering up these sexual abuses. So after that, the church has been in damage control mode since then, and we haven't heard anything since. But we know that, the Pope was forced to address the issue. He did issue, it wasn't exactly an apology, but he did address the issue of the residential schools, expressing sorrow, that I think the way he put it is some priests harmed some children. You know, it's what I call the bad apples theory. There's just a few bad apples in there rather than the whole system causing it.
We sure have a lot of few bad apples.
Yeah, well, a whole tree is bad, I think. But but no, it shows that they have to respond, and they've had to, right, because there's so many people coming forward now.
Is he not required to respond to the summons of the tribunal?
No, he's claiming diplomatic immunity as a head of state, that he doesn't have to answer to anybody. Which is not even true, because under international law, a head of state can be tried for crimes against humanity. They tried it against Milosevic in Serbia. And so that isn't even a valid argument, just because he's head of state. But he isn't actually a head of state. That the Vatican doesn't actually have recognized status as a state under international law.
Really? I always thought that they did.
No, it's a big myth. The United Nations allowed them observer status in 1966 because of a private deal. There was never a vote taken at the UN to allow the Vatican in, and it's still not seen as a state under international law. It just poses as that, and everybody kind of goes along with it, because of the power that the Catholic Church has, all the Catholic voters in different countries and that, but they, and they've got a lot of financial resources behind them, too, but the reality is, no, they don't have that. And anyway, they can't have it both ways. If they are a government under international law, they have to abide by certain international conventions, like the Human Rights Conventions, the Rights of the Child. And under those laws, the Pope can definitely be brought to trial as soon as he steps outside the Vatican. So, that's not a valid argument. And in fact, that's why these two German lawyers are trying to do exactly that. They're trying to sue Ratzinger as a German citizen. For aiding and abetting child rapists.
Is that why you use his civilian name and not his church given name?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, that is his name, and any citizen, regardless of their position in a head of state or whatever, can be tried for normal, criminal acts. So that's what they're trying to do for sure.
Well, this is fascinating. We do have a lot of audience questions, and we're going to be taking a short break right now and coming back to speak with Kevin and Ed again and to address some of the questions from our listening audience. So thank you, folks. We'll be back in just a moment.
Got questions? The library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library. Got questions? The library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us. But for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes. All are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live. where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to earthshare.org now. A public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
Hello, everybody. The People Speak Radio, back again with Kevin Annette, award-winning documentary filmmaker of Unrepentant. You can go and read about all the information that Kevin and I have been talking about at www.hiddenfromhistory.org. Kevin, I'm going to read this. We will bring to light the hidden works of darkness and drive falsity to the bottomless pit. For all doctrines founded in fraud or nursed by fear shall be condemned by truth. Can you tell us who wrote that?
Well, that was my ancestor, Peter Annett, and he was a humanist philosopher in England in the 1760s who was imprisoned at age 70, put in the public stocks in Charing Cross in London, and eventually died right when he came out of prison. Because he wrote a pamphlet that criticized the Bible and parts, you know, and the authority of the Church of England. I just think it's kind of ironic that 2.5 centuries later, I seem to be fighting the same battle.
Yeah, and that's why I brought it up. I find it remarkably aligned in so many ways. But here, you started out as a reverend, a minister of the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's. It is kind of ironic, and I think for me it's like, whether or not you believe in reincarnation, I don't know that, but I do believe that there's kind of patterns in families and people when they die. I do think that the dead look to us to carry on their hopes and dreams, and especially something like this. It's interesting, right when I started this work, I used to have dreams of young Indian kids trying to speak to me all the time, and eventually I had a dream where a little girl kept saying to me over and over, they're buried between the walls. And they were desperate to try to get that message to me. I often, I've spoken to people who are janitors in these buildings where the residential schools used to be. And one man told me that that he often hears children crying at night and banging on windows and things like that. You know, I think these spirits are restless, definitely. And, you know, the last quote in our film Unrepentant, it's from Voltaire. It says, we owe respect to the living, but to the dead we owe only the truth. And I think that that's, you know, none of us can really rest until the full truth is said. You know, that's kind of a big reason why I do this.
Well, first of all, I do believe in reincarnation, and I believe that I do believe in the power of dreams and dream worlds. So, yes, I do understand how these things can come to light. You were given the name Eagle Strong Voice by Chief Lewis Daniels, Whispers Wind. He is the elder of a Turtle Clan in the Anishinaabe Nation of Winnipeg, Manitoba. And he says, he speaks strongly and with truth. He speaks for our stolen and murdered children. I ask everyone to listen to him and welcome him. That is quite an honor.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about being honored in this way by this incredible nation?
Well, it was really moving. It happened in the spring of 2004, and my family is from Winnipeg. My mom's family came from Scotland there when they were driven out of the Highlands and lost their land, and they settled there. And I have cousins who are Cree and Métis Indians in Manitoba because, you know, there's a lot of intermarriage that went on. But I was actually invited into a healing circle there, and I met Louis Daniels. He's passed on now into the other world, but he adopted me as a son, and gave me that name. And he said to me at that meeting that I couldn't speak for his people and he couldn't speak for mine, but walking side by side, we could get both cultures to look at this. And because ultimately we need one another. We need to share this, to take responsibility jointly for this. And then I realized after that, that pretty much was my job, to be able to speak to my people and say, look at where this is coming from. It isn't just one law or one country. It was a whole global kind of genocide that went on. So I think for me, it was when he gave me that name, it was a way for him to not only kind of authorize what I was doing on his territory, but to say that it's time to broaden this, to simply not talk about, you know, putting this in terms of money and apology, which is not what the issue is about at all, but rather look at ourselves in the mirror and make sure we don't do this anymore. And that's, you know, when I look at what goes on in Iraq and Afghanistan and around the world, I think, well, you know, I guess we're still at it, you know.
We have some questions here, Kevin, from our listeners. One is Kat in Australia, and she asks, which churches in Canada are implicated in the abuse/genocide allegations?
In Canada, it's the Roman Catholic Church, the Anglican Church or the Church of England, and the United Church of Canada, which is Presbyterian and Methodist. So it's really all the main Protestant and Catholic denominations.
Can I ask you, in light of this, in light of the fact that, you know, either all religious people are a bunch of freaks that are going around murdering children and pedophiles, or is it just that children were not revered or respected in any way, shape, or form at one time, that these things could happen very easily, and it was commonplace during that period of time, Kevin?
Well, you know, it was definitely commonplace to treat children that way, although among Indians, there were no boundaries. I mean, if you wanted to go and rape and kill a native child, you could do it. Just like today, there's lots of missing native women all over the country. There's lots of native men who get killed in prisons by the police. It happened to a friend of mine just last year. Johnny Dawson, who was a member of our group in Vancouver, got beaten so badly by three Vancouver cops that he died. And they issued a death certificate saying he died of alcohol withdrawal when he had been sober for several years. You know, I mean, it's a standard way that you can do to a native in this country. So it isn't just how we treated children. It was that whole racist kind of attitude, too, towards natives. But definitely when you look in the European tradition, children were seen, and this comes out of the whole doctrine of the fall and you know, the fact that children are somehow born sinful and creation is cursed. I mean, that whole attitude leads to seeing that there's something wrong with innocence, that children need to be beaten and molded into what their parents want or what the system wants and requires. And I think that will inevitably lead to these kinds of crimes. So I think it's kind of in the fabric of our culture, but it's also definitely came out of kind of the attitude towards Indians.
Mm. Interesting. We have more questions. Reese in Wisconsin asks, can the guest tell us about his first personal experience that roused his suspicion as a minister that the church he was working for had a history of abuse against natives?
Yeah, I mentioned this in our film on Repentant. It's the very first home I ever visited, the native home on my visits. I was invited to do a wedding in a native home just about a week after I got to Port Alberni in the fall of 1992. And I went out to the home of a man called Danny Gus, who was an Indian fisherman who had gone to the Alberni residential school run by the United Church, who I worked for. And I asked Danny why there weren't any natives in my church, which I had noticed right away. The first Sunday in my pulpit, I noticed it was all white, even though a third of the population was native. And he eventually told me that his best friend had been killed in the residential school and beaten to death and then buried in the hill behind the school. He said everybody in the church knew about it, and they didn't want us there. And that's why they kind of kept all the Indians out of the church, because they had a big guilty conscience. I mean, that's the kind of story I heard in the very first native home, and literally in every other home I went into when I you know, got to know the people well enough, those kinds of stories were told, because they knew that I was somebody that they could open up to. And I began to hear this all over, And, you know, that's for me how it began. It also was the fact that in many of the Native homes, I began to have to do funerals for Native teenagers who'd killed themselves. The teenage suicide rate is like 30 times the national average among Natives. And a lot of the young children died. And I knew that all of that was coming from somewhere that wasn't being talked about. So it was also the effect today in the Native communities, you know, just made me realize I had to dig deeper and find out why that was happening.
John from the Canadian Rockies asks, Kevin, when do you expect to speak in northern British Columbia?
Well, I'm glad he asked that, because I'm actually, in July, I'm going on a cross-country tour, and I'm going up to northern BC, and then down through Alberta, and all through Western Canada, and then in the east. I'm starting early July, so I plan to be in northern BC sometime in the first week in July. And if people want to get a hold of me about that, my email is hiddenfromhistory@yahoo.ca.
I hope you got that, John. Rob in Vancouver, Canada. I first became aware of you after reading a story you wrote called Psychic Forces. Would you care to provide a synopsis of that story and any thoughts you've had about it since?
It might have been by a different title, because I think it wasn't that title specifically, so I'm trying to remember the one he's referring to. I can only guess, so maybe I could ask him for a bit more specifics about what was in the article, and that way I'd be able to kind of address that.
Rob, if you have any more specifics about that, maybe we can go from there. In the meantime, we have a question from Mike, or Gloria, I'm sorry, Gloria in Missouri. What, if any, retaliation has there been against Kevin for his work in exposing the crimes against Natives?
Well, it started when I lost my job. The church lawyers went to my wife at the time and helped, urged her to divorce me and help pay for her divorce. So I lost custody of both my daughters, who are actually grown women now. They're in university, and we actually have a good relationship. But my whole family was destroyed by it. Unable to work. I've been living under a blacklisting for about 15 years. A lot of death threats, physical attacks, a continual smear campaign aimed at the Native community so that eyewitnesses won't come forward and share this stuff. It's an ongoing kind of assault. And actually, in the last year, it's gotten worse, because as we've gotten support from around the world and more active endorsements from groups coming forward, definitely this kind of dirty tricks campaign has reared its head again. But I often say to people, the best way to counter that is just with the evidence and the truth and sticking to the issue. You know, it's not really about me at all. It's about the truth and the evidence of these crimes.
I know Mike in California had originally asked if there were any kind of responses from the appearances of Stephen Harper or Pope Ratzinger. We discussed Pope Ratzinger. What about Stephen Harper?
Well, there's an election campaign going on right now, and you know, it looks like Harper's going to be reelected, but with his Conservative Party. But when I delivered the summons to the Prime Minister's office, we have had no response whatsoever. You know, to that summons.
We have Rob from Vancouver said it was published at Rents.com. The official title was Psychic Forces at Work.
I'm trying to remember what that referred to, because, I mean, I can say generally that there was, you know, involvement. About 5 years ago, there was a number of people who came to me who were kind of warning me that there had been, you know, they were picking up some serious kind of dark energy being thrown my way. And I know that what the article might be referring to was the fact that there was two men on Vancouver Island who apparently had been hired to do exactly that, to kind of invoke fairly dark psychic energy in my direction. Now, you know, I don't like to talk very lightly about this, because I've been, sensitive to the fact that people have different views about that. So I'd be quite willing to go into more detail of that, but I'd need more kind of information about what the article was saying.
Well, I can imagine that people can have different views on the psychic forces, but I always find it strange when people of faith do, because isn't, after all, that exactly what we're talking about? The psychic forces of prayer, the psychic invocations that we chant in churches, the requests, prayer lines, all asking for some kind of psychic force to be at work, either advocating for us or against us, I guess, although most people pray for something good, I would hope. You know, boy, so much to do. Can I ask you, what do you want to see happen here?
Well, to some degree, it's already happening. I mean, the walls are coming down in many ways because the truth is out. But what I need and what I would like to see happen is for, first of all, there to be an international investigation into this, because the truth is not going to come out within Canada. We need an international war crimes trial where all of this evidence can be brought out. We need the graves, there's a repatriation process, and there to be forensic analysis done so we can have cause of death determined. We need museums where this full history is told. We need the evidence, and you know, that I've gathered and other people have gathered, right in the high school curriculum, so that you know the next generation can be learning about this stuff. And we need to continue to help the people on the ground who are still suffering from this. And that's a lot of the work I do. And I find that now that the issue has become international, it's a lot easier to do this work because it's not I'm not a voice in the wilderness anymore. There's more people coming forward. So I think all of those things are needed, but mostly what we need is a personal response. We need to get people to come forward and see that this issue, again, there's the word issue, but you know, this thing we're talking about is not isolated from their own life, because you know, if this can happen to one group in society, it can be aimed at any of us. And I think more and more, as you see these repressive laws brought in and people's rights threatened everywhere, I often say, well, it's like living under the Indian Act, because under the Indian Act in Canada, you're not a citizen. You're a ward of the state. You can even have involuntary hospitalization under the Indian Act in Canada. And if those kinds of laws are allowed against Native people, they can be brought in, and they have actually been brought in under Homeland Security laws and that. So I just think it's a matter for all of us now.
I absolutely agree. You know, one of the things that I've always said was freedom is an illusion under governments and under churches, apparently, as well, because once they give you this freedom, they are likely to take it back at any given time.
That's right.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. And then, you know, you did speak during, we've only got another minute or so, but you did speak about that the truth is the only thing that will free people. And one of the things that I believe it was Benjamin Franklin had said, and I'm paraphrasing here, when you imprison a people, be prepared to wear the shackles yourself.
Right.
And hopefully one day these people will be brought to justice. I applaud you, the work that you do. Please continue. As a Palestinian, I know very well the genocide of a people and how insidious and the damage that it does to a nation's spirit, and you feel so alone in the world. And so, yes, I do understand, and I pray for your continued strength in this.
Thank you.
And thank you.
I'll just mention that my latest book you can get through Amazon is called Unrepentant, Disrobing the Emperor. And you can also read my other book online, hiddennolonger.com. And if people want to get a hold of me again, it's hiddenfromhistory@yahoo.ca. And thank you for having me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. And you can get all that information on our website at www.thepeoplespeakradio.com. So there we go, folks. Thank you very much. Next week's guest is Laila Masri and Soraya Sahir, Afghans for Peace, right here on the People Speak Room. Thank you very much, and have a great week.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.